There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent and as timeless as when Justin met Kelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. I, alas, am not Nathan Rabin. Actually, I am the darkness. I am the night. I am Clint Worthington, a senior writer for film and TV over at Consequence of Sound, and co-host of the podcast Alcohollywood.
And in this multiverse and in all others, I am Nathan Rabin, the eponymous host of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. And I guess the namesake of Nathan Rabin's Happy Place, which is my website where we write about lots and lots and lots of terrible movies.
And we're joined once again by another repeat guest, very, very excited to bring back to the show, Dan McCoy from the Flophouse. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how's everybody? I don't know why I said that. You're the only ones who can answer. The listener at home cannot.
Well, I presume that they are very pleased to hear you.
Well, we're great at branding here. The Happy Cast, which is why we're so unbelievably successful. So we got one of the people who is the best and funniest in the world at talking about really terrible movies. And we're only going to talk about great movies.
Yeah, spoiler alert. We like pretty much all of the movies that we're going to be talking about. Well, first off, in case people don't know, Dan, where can they find your stuff?
Flophousepodcast.com is the best place. That's my podcast, The Flophouse. I don't know if... Why don't you watch The Daily Show? Why not?
Yeah,
that's my day job. So
yeah, there you go. Make that happen.
Keep supporting that.
Right. But yeah, like Nathan said, this is gonna be a bit of a change of pace for us. Not in, you know, that we don't normally talk about superhero movies all the time, because such is the pop culture landscape we live in.
It's the only thing that exists in this moment in time.
Right. But we are blessed to actually talk about some good ones this time around. Not that we've shied away from good ones. There are fun ones we've liked. But anyway, a particularly good one just came out this past weekend. Spider-Man:Into the Spider-Verse. And so we're going to talk about that, and then we actually are going to talk about another great animated superhero movie, Batman Mask of the Phantasm. And then we'll kind of just talk generally about comic book movies that we enjoyed throughout this year.
It's funny that you mentioned The Desolation of Smaug before.
It's pronounced Smaug.
Smaug? The Desolation of Smaug?
Smaug. God, Nathan,
the
get it right.
The Desolation of Smaug. Okay, it's important that I know this because I would like to announce... In 2019, my year flops to The Desolation of Smaug.
Yay.
That's right. In 2008, I was kind of looking for a direction and a career that did not seem to be going anywhere. And I launched My Year of Flops, where I watched, I think, 52 or 104 movies over the course of 1 year. It ended up going really, really well. It kind of defined me as a writer and a human being. So I was thinking of ways that I can make 2019 special. So I decided that in 2019, there will be 52 My World of Flops case files. Every Wednesday, there will be a new My World of Flop piece. And you might be wondering, like, you know, with sequels, they're generally of two different kinds. You know, you have your passionate, organic sequels where you have a story that needs to be told. And then you have, you know, the ones born of desperation, you know, and this, I think, a little from column A, a little from column B. So 2019 will be My Year of Flops 2, The Desolation of Smaug. And yes, that will be the official what's the word for it? Subtitle.
Until you get that cease and desist letter from New Line.
That's true. I should probably figure out how to pronounce Smaug before I. But anyway, I'm very, very excited about this, and God willing, there will also be 52 Control Nathan Raven pieces next year. So about half of the content is already lined up, and I think we're going to move the date of each Happy Cast Wednesday as well.
That'll just give me a little bit more, yeah, that'll give me a little bit more time to edit things, because we usually record these on Monday, and it takes a lot of work to edit a podcast, so I want to make sure I can get them out consistently for everybody and make sure they're as good as possible,
for sure.
So yeah.
So every Wednesday on the website, there's going to be in My World of Flaps case file. I think the first one is going to be on the character of Jar Jar Binks. I've never actually done a My World of Case file about a character, and it would be hard to call the Phantom Menace a failure, but I think if any character flopped, if any character is reviled, if any character lives in infamy and notoriety, it's Jar Jar Binks. So I'm very excited about immersing myself in this world, and it seemed appropriate to announce this, because, you know, the Flop House, which I absolutely adore, I felt like it's kind of analogous, only, you know, the Flophouse being way, way, way better, and less self-indulgent and way funnier. But yeah, that was also about a decade old. So I feel like we've been going on these parallel tracks. So it seemed like with Dan as the guest for this episode, a good time to announce that.
There's definitely a symbiotic relationship, I have to say, because I've heard about a few things that we've done on the Flophouse because of you.
Well, I'm glad that I brought Easy Rider the ride back into your world.
Aren't we all? Aren't we all grateful for that? But before we get into the episode in earnest, I do want to point out that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/NathanRavensHappyCast. Devastated to report we have not picked up new patrons since last episode, which I'm very sad about. But you can change that. Be the change you want to see in this world. And pledge at least a dollar or more to our podcast or to our Patreon. We'll throw out some bonus stuff every once in a while. It'll just help us keep the lights on.
We'll say your name on the podcast.
Indeed. Do you want us to say your name in our dulcet tones? Do you not? Maybe don't answer that. So if you want to have that all happen for you, and I know you do, put it on your vision board and pledge to patreon.com/NathanRavensHappyCast. Well, without further ado, I say we all jump into the multidimensional web of Spider-Man to the Spider-Verse.
Put into a sticky situation, as it were.
Quite. All right, yeah, it's time for Scalding Hot Takes. Now, Nathan, we watched a particularly good one, didn't we?
We did. We watched the big Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse movie. I saw this on Friday. I've been just waves upon waves upon waves of hype. And I really, 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 really enjoyed it, but it was kind of a sensory overload. I wrote my piece about this for Scalding Hot Takes. It goes up, I think, on Wednesday, and I literally summarized the film's plot as a bunch of crazy shit happens. And normally I would say that was like very unprofessional, or that I wasn't doing justice, or I was being very reductive. However, I feel like it actually kind of honors the spirit of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse to say that a bunch of crazy shit happens. It's also not inaccurate.
No, I've been describing this movie as like overstuffed, but like I mean that in a good way. Like it has so much going on in it, and that can be a bad thing in a movie, but in this case, it just feels like they had just an excess of creativity that they somehow managed to put it all into one movie, and it all pretty much works.
I was just going to say that, you know, this movie was co-written and produced by the team of Lord Miller from the Lego movies, from 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street, from getting fired off of Solo. And what it has in common with those movies, I think, is this kind of sense of childlike sense of play. Specifically, I look at my son Declan when he's playing, and he doesn't delineate between, you know, which characters are Marvel, which characters are DC, who does what. Everything just kind of goes into a giant pot of this is pop culture, and I love it, and I can play with all of it. And I feel like Lord and Miller are kind of brought that aesthetic to the movies in a very big way, and it makes movies like this intoxicating, but also overwhelming in a very, very pleasurable sort of way. Like, it's too extra, it's too much, and I kind of fucking loved it about that.
It would be hilarious to go back to talk to 2011 Clint, someone who is like just in the middle of seeing something like Andrew Garfield's gonna reboot Spider-Man, and tell him that in 27 years later, not only will Spider-Man be rebooted again, but he will be rebooted twice. And two movies featuring Spider-Man will come out in the same year, and they'll both like be relatively critically lauded. And I think I would call my future self insane. But yeah, there is something incredibly creative and freewheeling and novel about Spider-Verse. I think you kind of had to do something this crazy and overstuffed and everything, especially because it deliberately evokes the feel of comic books, which especially in like the Marvel universe, there is, it's been so running so long that you have accumulated all of these different dimensions and universes and alternate timelines and different stylistic takes on the same character. So the question becomes like, how do you mix it all together and make it work? Well, and I think that's borne out.
My question for you is, why do you think it's taken this long for there to be a theatrically released motion picture specifically rooted into the idea and the world of the multiverse?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe they underestimate, or they underestimated audiences' ability to take that, honestly. I think it took comic book culture and like pop culture and nerd culture to reach the mainstream to this point where they felt they could comfortably bank a several hundred million dollar movie on this like pop culture esoterica that like nerds like us were beaten up for knowing in high school, and suddenly like, no, Spider-Ham is super cool. Like, the kids love him. You buy some Funko Pops of Spider-Ham. We're also talking about it in terms of this comic book continuity and stuff, but the important thing to remember too is that not only do Lord and Miller have this innate ability to be that playful and be that energetic, but also focus it in this really uncanny way into still making it a grounded, coherent, emotionally moving story in the middle of all this like Sturm und Drang.
Totally. What do you think, Dan? Why do you think it's taken until 2018 to get a proper multiverse motion picture?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that people would think it's too wacky in the past. I mean, you know, it takes, you know, three Spider-Man reboots for us to be ready for one Spider-Ham.
Yeah, you know, like, that's a good point. Yeah,
once we've like exhausted that, we're just like, yeah, sure, a pig that has Spider-Man powers, that's fine.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think it's kind of an idea that's too crazy and too dense for comic book movies before, and I feel like we've evolved as a culture, and particularly as a comic book worshipping, comic book focused culture, that we can handle something like this that's so fucking crazy and so insane and so over the top. I was looking, a little later we're going to do our list of the 3 to 5 best superhero movies. And I'm like, how many superhero movies are this year? There must be like, what, 6 or 7? It can't be that hard to make out a list. Just movie after movie after movie. And this year alone, we saw Batman by Gaslight, a steampunk Batman movie that went direct to video, Batman Ninja. you can probably guess what Batman Ninja is, featuring Sumo Bane. Again, this is something that is officially exists in the Warner Brothers universe that was put out by Warner Brothers, Batman Ninja, Sumo Bane.
No one knew who I was before I put on the diaper.
Exactly. That wasn't an impenetrable enough Scottish accent there. And then finally, the only of these Batman movies that I've actually seen, because I have a 4-year-old boy, Batman, The Brave and the Bold, which was the Batman Scooby-Doo team-up movie. And here's the thing about the world that we live in, 2018, really fucking good. I can unreservedly recommend Batman the Brave and the Bold to the point that it is actually number 7. On my list of the top superhero movies. So we've kind of gotten into a world where we can handle this. I feel like it took us a very, very, very long time. Because I feel like, again, these ideas, the idea of the multiverse, it was too dense and too crazy and too kind of inside comic books for film. It felt like that was something you could do in television. It was something you could do in comic books. But again, I feel like we've evolved to a place where we're ready for it. We've also evolved to the point where, God, I remember 8 fucking years ago when they said, hey, wouldn't it be great if Donald Glover was Spider-Man? And people lost their fucking shit. They're like, no, the SJWs have gone too far.
We were all talking about SJWs in 2008.
Society will shatter if this happens. Will Trump get elected president? And again, like literally just, 7 years ago, I guess inspired by Donald Glover and Barack Obama, they created Miles Morales, who is a black Spider-Man. And again, if you can have a Batman by Gaslight, a Ninja Batman, and a Batman that teams up with Scooby-Doo, I don't think it's that crazy to be like, hey, why isn't Spider-Man a black teenager?
Right.
And I'm pleased to say that nobody seems to be making a giant fucking deal out of this, because it's not a fucking deal. And if you have a problem with this, that says a lot more about you and your ideas about race and gender and representation than it does about this movie.
Right. And that's another thing to keep in mind, too, is amidst all the crazy Spider-Man noirs and the anime Spider-Man and all that stuff, and like the potential for craziness that happens with the Spider-Verse concept, it still stays grounded in the Miles Morales story, which is the first time you really get it in a feature film. And it's so refreshing and so great and such a wonderful way to update the Spider-Man character, where he is still that, like, the, you know, the reason we all related to Peter Parker as a kid is because he wasn't a Superman. He was this ordinary kid just trying to get by. And this is the modern version of that.
Ordinary kid who looked like Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, yeah, so cool. That's kind of one of the funny things, quick aside. Like, I like Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker, but hate his Spider-Man. I hate Andrew Garfield's Peter Parker, but like his Spider-Man a lot. And Tom Holland has a little, I know, hot take possibly. I think Tom Holland and Shameik Moore also, like, they managed to, you know, do both roles really adroitly. And he bounces so wonderfully off of the other Spider-Men, especially Peter B. Parker, the Jake Johnson one, the middle-aged tubby one, like the one with a little bit of paunch and like a little bit of scraggle on him.
Is he 26 or is he 36?
I think he's supposed to be more of a middle-aged Peter Parker in Spider-Verse, yeah. Because he's got like streaks of gray and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I think of him as sweatpants Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if you're a superhero and you're wearing sweatpants, that kind of says everything that needs to be said about that. And I didn't actually know who was playing Peter Parker in this. Jake Johnson, I thought, was pretty fabulous. Giving this kind of this sardonic, world-weary kind of scene at all. Kind of an asshole kind of quality to it. Then I guess I didn't realize that Chris Pine is also...
Yeah.
Spider-Man. Would anybody like to have a go at what the premise of this movie is, other than a bunch of crazy shit happening all at once?
Dan, would you like to give it a try?
So there's Miles Morales. He's a kid who eventually gets bitten by a radioactive spider himself, but at the beginning of the movie is just a normal kid. And he witnesses the Chris Pine Spider-Man dying because Kingpin is opening a rift to other dimensions, which we later find out is because he wants his wife and son back, who died. Did they leave him? I'm not sure what happened.
No,
I think they died. I think
he blames Spider-Man
for it. They ran off because they saw him fighting Spider-Man. Yeah, that's right. And then they get into a car crash.
That's right, yeah.
It's like, we thought better of you, King.
And so after the good Peter Parker, the sweatpants Peter Parker dies.
Yeah, his Peter Parker is a little bit more put together than like the other ones. Like, he's this platonic ideal. He's like the capital S superhero Peter Parker, to the point where he's even like merchandised himself in this universe, mm-hmm, with like Christmas albums and stuff. Yeah.
So once he dies, sweatpants Peter Parker shows up, and all he's interested in is getting back to his own dimension. They've all, like, all these other Spider-Men have been pulled into this dimension because the Chris Pine Spider-Man was pushed into this dimensional vortex. And so I guess that, for some reason, pulls all the alternate Spider-Man into his universe. And they all have to work together to keep the Kingpin from rebuilding this machine and opening up a vortex again, because every time he does it, it's more dangerous to the world around. Like, all the dimensions start merging and crazy things start happening. And because, like, actually, like, that's one of the things I liked the most about the movie, was the climax with all the dimensions merging into each other, is this crazy color and light show of a way that you, like, I had not seen in an animated movie before, and I will admit that I may have had an edible before seeing this film, and it certainly enhanced the last 20 minutes of the movie greatly.
For sure, for sure. Well, then let's talk about the visual style, because I agree with you. I genuinely don't think we've seen anything like this before. The art style is so fascinating. I think I read somewhere that they had to actually like patent some of the technologies that they developed for this, because it's such this, it's this crazy collage of different art styles. It cribs from traditional comic book art to the point where they have like the dot technique that they use in traditional comic books, and like the words and the in the air and the comic book panels, but also things like street art, like the street art that that Miles does, like permeates some of the screen. And there's even like weird little tricks that I loved, like in the background, to sort of give this illusion of depth, they would do that sort of interpolation thing that you would see, like if you're going to a 3D movie and you're not seeing, you don't have your glasses on, that kind of red blue overlap thing to like show a little bit of depth of field.
Yeah.
So fascinating. I love the way they use that and like everything else. And that's to say nothing of like the differing art styles of the different Spider-Men that come in, and yet it all feels seamless. It's incredible.
Well, one of the things that I love about comic books in general, and specifically the multiverse, is this idea that theoretically anything can happen. Like the possibilities are limitless, they're endless. And yet, because of, you know, the way that Hollywood is a little bit on the terrified side, we just hear the same stories and see the same stories over and over again. And, you know, these stories are overwhelmingly origin stories, creation stories. And I felt like it did something kind of interesting and neat and very 2018 with that, is that you get a bunch of very, very, very condensed origin stories here. They're basically like, okay, here's what happened. Spider, yeah. Trauma, supervillain. Okay, we're up to date here. Because you don't have to do all this shit in 2018. You can trust your audience. You can respect your audience. You can figure out that in 2018,
we don't see a single Uncle Ben, do we?
It's going to know a whole bunch of shit about Spider-Man. You don't need to hold their hands while everything happens. You don't have to go through the same things that every other superhero movie does. I loved the other Spider-Mans, obviously. you cannot go wrong with John Mulaney as Spider-Man. I could not have been more excited about that. I laughed out loud every time he said anything. You also have Nicolas Cage, who... it's having a fucking amazing year this year, which I have not been able to say since like 1996 or so. Between Mom and Dad, between he's doing really, really well.
And he played Superman in Teen Titans Go to the Movies earlier this year. So this year alone,
he's Spider-Man and Superman,
right? Banner year for Cage. And Kimiko Glenn, who I think is on Orange is the New Black, played Penny Parker, who I would have loved to have seen more of. I really like that idea. She was a cute little character.
Well, who is Penny Parker? Tell the audience who exactly is an official Spider-Man in this official Spider-Man motion picture.
I think she was just invented for like the specific Into the Spider-Verse comic that there was. And she's basically from an anime dimension where she doesn't have powers, but like she inherits this robot that kind of has Spider-Man like powers from her father, who invented the robot, and it's powered by a radioactive spider itself
that she has some sort of psychic link to.
That's right, yeah.
In a movie that had Spider-Ham, I thought that this was the wackiest idea for a Spider-Man character.
I would love to see the studio notes for this.
Yeah.
I would love to see what these, you know, 57-year-old studio executives say. Okay, and this character is from the distant future. She's a Japanese girl, and she has a psychic connection to a giant robot with weird insect powers. Be like, well, okay. If the kids are into it, I understand. But also watching this, I kind of came to understand why Lord and Miller got fired from Solo, because as beloved as this movie is, as much of an instant phenomenon as it is, I could never imagine a Star Wars movie with this kind of a sensibility. I feel like there's a hell's a poppin', go for broke, you know, stonery, kaleidoscopic quality to this that is absolutely perfect for this version of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. But I would have a very hard time imagining fitting into the universe of Star Wars, which is so relatively convincing. I mean, try and implement new things. Yeah. And you have, you know, the response to The Last Jedi from horrible people, and Jar Jar Binks from reasonable people. So yeah, I thought it was pretty fascinating that they've been able to do this in, you know, not
hey, they're putting Werner Herzog in a Star Wars TV show. Let's
true,
not count our
true,
chickens
yeah.
first. And Carl Weathers. I hope they have a scene together.
I hope so, but he's not the star, I don't think.
No, that's Oprah
and Martel.
It's a
little bit of a different situation.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And then there's also Spider-Gwen, who we haven't talked about at all, who's sort of the female lead. I would have to go back and rewatch it, but I don't know if... I think I would have liked a little bit more from her, but I understand how it all gets lost in the just the huge mess that it is. And it's a good kind of mess, a mess in the best possible way. Because she has really good chemistry with Shameik Moore, who I love. I'm really hoping that he gets to go on to do great things. If you've seen a movie called Dope that came out a couple years ago, he was the lead in that.
Oh, yeah.
And he was in Baz Luhrmann's short-lived Netflix show, The Get Down, which I actually kind of really dug. So, yeah, I was really excited to see that he was voicing Miles, and he does a wonderful job. Brian Tyree Henry plays his dad. Talk about people who are having great fucking
yeah.
years. Yeah, that scene, well, all the scenes with Miles and his dad broke my heart, like, and they filled my heart with joy. Like, that scene where he's walking away, it's in the trailer, when he's walking away without saying I love you in the cop car. Such a great little moment. And then there's a scene where, like, Miles' dad is trying to talk to him about, like, all the difficult things that he's going through right now, and Miles literally has no choice but to listen because he's not able to move or talk. That absolutely broke my heart. Like, so in amongst all this goofiness and, like, the genuinely affecting humor is some really, really great dramatic work, which I think is surprising.
I also, speaking of Miles, like, I also like how, you know, we've seen Spider-Man, you know, learning how to use his powers before, but we've never seen a Spider-Man quite as incompetent as Miles is at the beginning of this
yeah.
movie. Like, Spider-Men seem to go from 0 to 60 pretty quick in the movies. They get the hang of everything pretty easily, and this is a movie long process for him to learn how to, you know, harness his powers.
Well, because we're also seeing Spider-Man being taught how to use his powers
yeah.
by another Spider-Man, too, which I think is really interesting.
And this is a very nerdy thing to obsess about, but it's always kind of bothered me that in addition to having the powers of a man-sized spider, Peter Parker created web shooters of his own design
yeah.
When he was, 17 years old?
Because he also was just
I'm
naturally
sorry,
a genius.
That's unrealistic. You can't be like Stephen Hawking and Batman at the same time. That's gilding the lily. He's a total Mary Sue. So I liked yeah, that there was a different one there. I also liked that I've been beating the dead horse that comic book movies are just, or comic books rather, are just funny animal stories for children. And I was amazed and delighted that for the first time, this is a major comic book movie, and probably the most satisfying element of it is a funny animal.
Yeah.
For children, I love Spider-Ham. I also loved that Spider-Ham has a real Looney Tunes quality to him. He seems very traditional animation, very kind of Chuck Jones, Frank Tashlin kind of thing. There's even a moment where he says, that's all, folks?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, can I say that for legal reasons? So I very much appreciated that for the first time ever, there is a very satisfying superhero movie that's also a funny animal story.
Well, and like in addition to his spider powers, it feels like his major superpower is having the physics of a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah.
Like just his survival abilities and the ability to like, you know, bring out a giant mallet out of just thin air, that kind of thing. those moments were all wonderful.
Yeah, and it's fun that like in a weird way, he's a very competent superhero too. he holds his own in a fight.
I know, it's really great. They even find time to give stuff for the villains to do. You know, like Kingpin gets a little bit of a motivation, and I love the way they designed Kingpin in this. Even though the weird part of me like saw that design and made me wonder how he had children. But you know, Liev Schreiber voices him, and you know, he does a pretty great job. But I loved Mahershala Ali as Uncle Aaron, who has more going on than I think I really want to reveal, since the movie's so new and I really do want people to see it. I mean, I guess if you've read the comics, you know who he ends up becoming. But it was nice to have that kind of torn between two dads kind of thing that Miles is going through, where there is his dad who sees Spider-Man as a menace and is pressuring Miles to attend this prestigious very, very white academy that he was smart enough to attend, but he feels out of place. And so there is this identity crisis between like the person that his dad wants to be and the person that his uncle lets him be. And so even just to find time amidst all of that to fit that in too is super cool.
Yeah, well, I feel like one thing that kind of the best superhero movies of the year and generally have in common, they're rooted in a sense of family. You know, that was certainly true of Black Panther.
The Fast and Furious films. It's very strong sense of family there.
I mean, The Incredibles, too. I think what I loved about that was, in a lot of ways, it was about, you know, a dad dealing with, you know, not being the main provider anymore. A dad kind of learning to be a house husband. So, yeah, I felt all of those elements were... very effective, and I feel like one of the inherent drawbacks of a multiverse movie or multiverse story is because everything can be undone, because there are galaxies where everything is completely different, the stakes aren't quite as high. So I thought the fact that this managed to have authentic, genuine emotional stakes, a story that's crazy and kooky, you know, and has noir Batman playing with a Rubik's Cube, and still have audiences care about these characters and their journeys, such as they are.
Sometimes I let a match just burn down to my fingers so I can feel something. That was pretty great. So, oh yeah, and on top of all of this, they find the time to throw in an awesome gender-swapped Doc Ock voiced by Catherine Hahn.
Oh yeah, she's so great.
Just out of nowhere. Yeah. She's great. And I loved the design of her too, the way her like her tentacles are these like kind of weird plastic things, so it feels a lot more pliable and it moves in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all just so, so friggin' good. I don't know if there's anything more that I can say about it, except what do we think of the Stan Lee cameo?
I was very, very moved by it.
Yeah.
You know, I think I hadn't, you know, necessarily been thinking about it, but yeah, I got a little bit choked up. I probably would have gotten choked up even if he hadn't died, even if this wasn't maybe his last performance. But yeah, there's, you know, and it's always such a personal thing, you know, for Stan Lee. So yeah, I was very, very moved by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dan, what about you?
Well, I mean... Because I'm a comedy writer and I deal with feelings through horrible jokes,
yeah.
Like my immediate thought upon Stan Lee's death was like, oh, now there's going to be an unmotivated shot of an urn in every Marvel movie.
Oh no!
But let's take a step back and reestablish me. Reestablish me as not a monster.
Yeah.
And say
that is a dark joke, but a very funny.
It could be worse. They could pull a Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, but I just want to say, so to counteract that, I was very moved because of the passing, and it was a sweet cameo too. It was, you know, sometimes he feels shoehorned in.
It felt fitting in a way they probably didn't expect when they were filming it. Kind of like how every scene with Carrie Fisher in The Last Jedi, whenever a character is talking to her, it feels like they're saying goodbye. Like that kind of thing. So yeah, and this is also coming from somebody, like there has already been a more recent Stan Lee tribute homage in a movie, because I had to review Once Upon a Deadpool, the PG-13 cut of Deadpool 2. And I will say, I rather dug all the stuff about that movie that wasn't Deadpool 2. But there is actually a post-credits like little mini documentary like tribute to Stan Lee at the end of that somehow is also really, really affecting, because it had footage of him in an interview being asked how he thinks he should be remembered, or he would like to be remembered after he's gone. He was just he was very, very humble and very matter of fact about it. And he's like, I just wanted, you know, it would be great if people said, you know, he told really good stories. You know, it's not really for me to say I'm not going to be around. But like that kind of thing was really, really sweet. So seeing that 1-2 punch of that feels like a culture that owes so much to Stan Lee dealing with the death, like through these cameos and through these explorations.
He didn't say I want to be remembered as a shameless self-promoter.
No. Or the elder abuse lawsuits near the end there. Those were not bright shining spots for him. But I think you know, that scene in Spider-Verse is a very, very apt one, and I think it's very important. It feels very significant that he's the one to hand Miles his like trainer Spider-Man costume. It's just the cherry on top of a really delicious, messy pie that has a million ingredients in it.
That's an interesting baking metaphor. It's a as someone who bakes pies, that I don't know if it's an accurate metaphor, but no.
Let's say I would not make Star Baker on Great British Bake Off. Yeah.
Now, Dad, were you offended that of all these spider people in this movie, there wasn't one named Spider Dan, who was a version of you but Spider-Man?
You know, there was before. So for my podcast, The Flophouse, before we were recording, there was a long discussion of the new characters that my co-host Stuart and I would have in a Star Wars movie, which of course would be Dan Solo and Stubaka. But I was not offended about the lack of a Spider Dan in the Spider-Verse.
Well, because there's like a spider version. I was literally like the only thing that they don't have like a Spider-Man version of Incredible Hulk. And that's probably only because they're like different companies. It seems like, yeah, there's like it's like porn. If you can imagine it, there is a Spider-Man or a Batman or a Superman version of it.
God, what else is there to say about this thing? I mean, it's really good. Go see it. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Because, I mean, it's going to make a bunch of money. And it's probably going to win Best Animated Film. I think there's a lot of real big buzz around it. Which is wild because you'd think a movie called Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse might win some technical awards, but that's it. Yeah, it's a really, really good time. Let's move on. It is Control, Nathan and Clint, and presumably Dan time. Nathan, what were our options this time around?
Oh, goodness. Again, this year, I wanted to make it appealing to Dan as humanly possible, and also to give ourselves a bit of a break and talk and watch a movie that is good and that people love. So our two options were Teen Titans Go to the Movies, which I have not seen yet, and I'm very excited because I love the TV show, and then Batman Mask of the Phantasm, which I've never actually seen because it came out in 1993, and I was just getting laid left and right. I was 17 years old. I was quarterback of the football team. I was, president of the baiting squad. No, I did not see it. I think because I was just like one of those people where.
Wait, did you say president of the dating squad?
I think I actually said president of the debating squad.
Okay.
The dating squad.
Just as little. You're drinking
all the beers.
Oh, God.
I was touching a lot of boobs back then.
I was. They felt like sand. So I was a big fucking nerd, but I was a movie nerd. I wasn't a television nerd. I wasn't an animation nerd. So even though this was related to Batman, which I fucking loved, I remember in 1989 buying the novelization of Batman the movie and being genuinely upset that there were a bunch of scenes in it that weren't in the film itself. And then Batman Returns, I think I loved even more because I was a total Tim Burton fanboy. And I'm like, this Batman movie is good, but it doesn't feel enough like a Tim Burton movie. I need a movie that feels way more like a Tim Burton movie than feels like a Batman movie. And that's what I got in Batman Returns. And watching Batman Mask of the Phantasm, I felt a real sense of deja vu. Because this feels like, I think of all the sort of Batman movies, it feels most akin to Batman Returns. I think primarily because of the romance between it. It's kind of this very goth, very moving, very kind of effective love story. It's kind of impossible love story, in addition to being a story about Batman and gangsters and the Joker. I think this was an interesting one to watch along with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse because they're both really good films. They both are very true to the characters. But in other ways, they're very different. This feels like a very minimalist film. This one, very classic, in a real kind of film noir and an art deco in a deeply rooted in the past kind of way. This is also 76 minutes long, and my God, they make the most out of every single one of those minutes. So what about you guys? What are your history with Batman Mask of the Phantasm?
Well, I certainly watched the Batman television show that was from the same creative team, and enjoyed it a lot at the time. I never saw this movie when it came out. And I have to say, so continuing my trend of paying less attention to the second film that you asked me to watch that started with me being sick and falling asleep for Flash Gordon last time you had me on the show, I have to admit that I watched Batman Mask of the Phantasm the day after the Daily Show holiday party, where I was up until 4:30 in the morning and then had to go to work the next day. So I watched it at the end of that day, and so I may not have absorbed everything as effectively as I would have on a better day. But I did enjoy the movie.
Hey, I think that's the perfect context to watch Batman Mask of the Phantasm. Like Dan, I grew up watching the I think Paul Dini TV show. I thought it was great. I thought the animated series is one of the best treatments of Batman there's ever been. And Mark Hamill especially is one of the best, if not the best Joker there's ever been. And yeah, I think I'd seen Mask of the Phantasm once or twice.
When you say that, do you know that you're pissing on Heath Ledger's grave?
Openly and proudly.
Okay. Because I thought he was a pretty talented actor who did a pretty good job. He won a little prize called The Academy Award.
Yes.
I don't see any Academy Awards on Mark Hamill's shelf.
Give it time. but anyway, yeah, I mean... I watched Mask of the Phantasm, I think, a couple times when I was a kid, and then I recently rewatched it a couple years ago for my podcast, Alcohollywood, where we did an episode on it, and we made like a cocktail and a drinking game for it. And it's funny you bring up Batman Returns, because quick plug, this upcoming week is our Christmas special, and we will be doing Batman Returns for that. And spoiler alert, that will be the last episode of the podcast before we retire it and move on to different things. But anyway, yeah, Mask of the Phantasm, I completely agree. I think it holds up really, really well as a great Batman story. I think it fits really nicely in this Art Deco, Golden Age kind of Great Gatsby version of Bruce Wayne that they've got going. And yeah, it's just a really simple story. Like, just real quick, the bare bones plot of Mask of the Phantasm is it turns out that there is this spooky ghost with a claw hand named the Phantasm that emits mist and is running around killing a bunch of gangsters. And it just so happens that the public and the city government is blaming Batman for it, all because he just happened to be sitting next to the guy who's standing next to the first guy that the Phantasm kills. But also, coincidentally, an old flame of Bruce Wayne's comes back into town and starts bringing up all kinds of memories. So we see flashbacks of like their life and their love before he took on the mantle of Batman. It all just gets mixed up in this scheme with gangsters teaming up with the Joker to try to save their own butts. Yeah, and it's a really, really tight story that's centered around these two characters, around Batman and Dana Delaney's character. Yeah, I just thought it was really, really solid.
Well, and I was kind of struck by, the first time that I'd seen it, I was kind of struck by how much Andrea Beaumont and Bruce Wayne kind of fall into the archetypes of the manic pixie dream girl and the sad sack mope that she inspires to have a lust for life, because she really does have this kind of fizzy, ebullient kind of, she's talking up a storm, she's funny, she's bright, she has a lot of personality. And Bruce, as you might know, he's a bit of a lump, he's a bit of a sad sack. And you get the sense that, you know, he comes alive in a way that he really doesn't otherwise. Although, you know, to be fair, one of the defining features of a manic pixie dream girl is that you have no internal drive, you have no strong needs. Andrea Beaumont, not to give too much away, has the best motivation of all, which is to get revenge. So again, you kind of have this Batman quality. I fucking love the voice cast here.
Yeah,
it's so great. The first mobster that gets knocked off, I'm like, God, who is that voice? And why do I love? Why does it feel so like home? It's Dick Miller.
Yeah,
like one of the greatest voices ever. Andrea Beaumont's dad is voiced by Stacey Keach. Mm-hmm. The great, great, great Stacey Keach. He also kind of does more than one voice. I don't want to give too much away there. There's also a wonderful, wonderful scene with an ancient, ancient mobster who's hooked up to this oxygen tank, and he's kind of looks like a praying mantis, and he's voiced by Abe Vigoda. So they kind of
good
they did
fame.
Every of Good Burger fame, of Conan O'Brien show fame. Is he still alive? Did he die?
Yes.
Did he die recently?
Yeah, everyone keeps asking. Man. I think Abe Vigoda is just going to stay alive, just despite all the people who are like, is Abe Vigoda still alive?
I think so, because the joke was always that he was so old, like 20 fucking years ago. The joke was that he was insane that he was still alive.
Yeah. Well, and his character name is a deliberate homage to his character from The Godfather.
Oh yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And again, kind of in the world of 2018, superhero movies and comic book movies, it seems like every movie has between 7 to 78 superheroes. I think there literally was something like 47 to 72 superheroes and villains in the Avengers movie. So it was kind of fascinating to kind of go back in time and see where they're not just throwing out every single Batman villain. But for the first half of this movie, there are no familiar Batman villains, as far as I know. Is there? They're just kind of
right. And I guess it was goons. Similar
to mobsters, and the Phantasm is original to this. And yeah, then like the Joker is a late addition, but he's so wonderfully served in this because he is this element of chaos, kind of like Heath Ledger's character was, where the mob turns to a man that they don't understand. And it's my Michael Caine impression. It's pretty great. Look out, Steve Coogan. And so he's wonderful in there, and he's able to raise the stakes in this great, great way. It's funny because there's not even a Harley Quinn, but there is like this like animatronic figure that he sort of treats as kind of a Joker's wife that I thought was kind of funny. I was very curious as to why Harley Quinn wasn't in that.
Yeah, well, there isn't Robin in this either, and I think part of the genius of this is that it's so streamlined and that it's so stripped down, and that even Joker, who once he shows up, he fucking dominates this movie, but it takes him a long time to get there. And there are all these really, really wonderful touches, like kind of in the first half of the movie, they introduce, I guess, kind of Gotham's version of the 1964 World Fair. There's something so inherently poignant about the idea of a World Fair and imagining the future, and it's all so optimistic, it's all so sunny. And I was actually thinking about this when I was writing my piece. We were promised jetpacks, we were promised all sorts of cool shit in the future, and granted we have iPhones that can literally do anything, but it feels like we were robbed.
Except fly on a jetpack.
Exactly. And then in the second half there's this wonderful thing where this World Fair that previously was this home of this optimism, of mankind's greatest aspirations for itself, has become this the Joker's hideout. It's this kind of run down, broken, dusty. If before this is the future as we imagine it, this is the future as it actually exists, and it's pretty sucky. And it makes sense that the Joker would hide out there, and that would be his sort of his world.
Well, and it reflects the way Bruce has changed too, because we first see the World's Fair thing with a happy, well-adjusted Bruce Wayne going on a date with just a swell gal, planning their future together, basically. And then as time and circumstance has broken down those expectations and those dreams, he's become this decrepit shell of a man in a bat costume, and the World's Fair reflects that, like being broken down and abandoned and lonely, just like he is.
Yeah. Can I say the interesting thing about this movie to me is, I would never say that cartoons are for kids. I'm an adult who is unhealthily interested in cartoons, and
silly Dan,
the best cartoons are made to appeal to a broad audience, including adults. But Mask of the Phantasm is something that I would have imagined was targeted at, like 13-year-olds in a way that, like a Pixar movie isn't necessarily, where they baked into it is the idea that a bunch of adults are going to see this thing. But that being said, Mask of the Phantasm spends so much time, like it is more than anything a romance. This movie spends so much time on the relationship, and it's just interesting to me thinking of, like a 13-year-old boy walking into this and being like, I'm going to see a Batman movie. And they see a movie about sort of regret and heartbreak.
No, totally.
A broken man who cannot allow himself to be loved.
Yeah.
Because that would
it's a remarkably mature Batman movie. Like, especially like an animated Batman movie.
Well, and I was trying to figure out why this movie bombed. It cost very little to make. It only cost $6 million to make, which seems insane because it looks so good and all the elements are handled so well. The score is absolutely amazing. But I was kind of thinking about why did this make less than $6 million? One of which is, we weren't living in the superhero saturated, superhero obsessed world that we're living in right now. The other thing is, this was an adaptation of a show that aired on Fox Kids. You know, this was a show that had, you know, Happy Meals and toys were there. And there's a bit of a disconnect between this very kind of somber, dark, mostly adult, noir-inflected, hard-boiled version of Batman. But it's also on Fox Kids. And also here are these toys. And they're actually one of the major twists and was actually ruined by the toy. The surprise villain, they actually had their costume and then outside of it. So if the people who created the toys did not care enough to not spoil the ending of this movie.
Right. Well, I think another factor was, if I remember reading it correctly, that they decided to put this in theaters really late. Like, I think it was just going to be a direct-to-video
thing.
And then just last minute they were like, oh, this is actually good enough to put in theaters, but they couldn't market enough of it in time.
Well, and compared to Batman Returns, which was this mega budgeted movie, you know, that people started looking forward to the moment that, you know, Batman ended, this was very much kind of a minor, you know, there's kind of a sense too that sort of television animation is less than, and that it's a different evolutionary step than feature film animation. I think this movie was kind of misunderstood and underestimated at the time of its release.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think of other elements that I just really love. I mean, going back to the score, God, that Shirley Walker score is so, so good. Like, especially, like, throwing in all those choral elements at the World's Fair and that opening montage, that opening sweeping shot, this, like, early CG shot of Gotham that, like, had it been any less cartoony, it wouldn't have worked, but there's a deliberate stylization to it that still makes that hold up, even as you recognize it's very early CG.
It's also like it goes such a long way towards establishing this as a movie, making this cinematic, making it melodramatic, making it not just be like, hey, this was a TV show people liked, so here's an extension of that, making it its own thing.
Dan, do we have any last thoughts on Mask of the Phantasm?
No, I also was struck by the fact that it had all these crazy character actors in it as voices. That was a delight to me, and another thing that made it seem like, wow, this is a weird sell for like the child audience.
Yeah.
No one's gonna be like, oh, Stacey Keach. Great. Yeah. My son loves Stacey Keach.
A lot of Joe Dante obsessives. Yeah. Like, yeah, oh my god, Dick Miller.
The Dick Miller.
Murray Golly, Futterman. Mom.
Yeah. Well, and I think that its virtues extend to the animated series as a whole too, and I think part of why it's so well regarded. I mean, I think it's not just because like Gen X kids and early millennials grew up watching it, and you know, we have a lot of nostalgia for it, but I think the stories themselves hold up because they're not just more mature, but they also feel weirdly timeless because they commit to this like specific 1920s kind of Art Deco period where it doesn't try to be contemporary to itself, and it doesn't try to be too kiddie and light. And so by taking on this kind of complex storytelling, it can hold up a little bit more, which is why when you watch this direct-to-video superhero movie in mid-90s, it holds up a little better than like even the first Iron Man when he like makes references to MySpace and is holding up flip phones, that kind of stuff. So
my experience of Tales from the Crypt. Like, Tales from the Crypt is so relatively timeless because everything is rooted in the 1950s, everything's rooted in the 1960s, everything is inherently retro, to the point where the last episode that I wrote about, and it goes up tomorrow, really great episode, but it's called Television Terror and it stars Morton Downey Jr. And Morton Downey Jr. plays a Morton Downey Jr. like piece of shit, and it's actually a really great episode. But his mere appearance alone dates it in a way that the rest of the show really does not. And there's nothing really to date, you know, Batman Mask of the Phantasm. It looks as good now as it did then. So, yeah, it's timeless in a way that, yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, likewise. It's great. Go see it. All right. Now, since we've been talking a lot about the kind of superhero renaissance we've been having of late, which just feel gross even saying that, but it happens. Superhero movies are really good right now. We thought we'd break down kind of our 3 to 5. Like, do we all have 5? So, Nathan, why don't you go first and do your number 5?
No.
Yes.
Alrighty.
It's your show, it.
Alrighty. Okay, so number 1 for this list is not going to be a big surprise. Black Panther. I feel like was not just a superior, top five superhero movie of all time. I felt like it was a bona fide cultural event. It was something people got excited about. It was something that meant something to people. I felt like there was such incredible expectations, such incredible hype. And for the movie to live up to that was pretty astonishing. And I felt like it's so rare in this day and age to see anything new when you go to the movies. And I felt like Black Panther was something new we've never seen. I mean, there have been black superheroes before, but there's never been a superhero so rooted in African culture and so rooted in African-American culture. And that was so Afrocentric in every conceivable way. I mean, if nothing else, you know, the fact that all of the actors wore natural hair, like that's a big thing and it matters. And it's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful that there are kids who are going to grow up idolizing Black Panther and looking up to Black Panther and loving that story and that world the same way that all of us grew up watching all white superheroes. And it got a little bit tedious. It really fucking did. It really, really, really did. Second, another universally beloved motion picture, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I probably do not need to delineate why I thought it was great because we just spent a half hour gushing over it. Number three might be a bit of a surprise. I fucking love Jews in superhero movies, particularly Paul Rudd, who, God, I got so fucking excited when I saw that he was being cast as Ant-Man. And I was so overjoyed that him and Edgar Wright were going to make a great movie together. And then I was very, very sad when Edgar Wright dropped out of the project. I wept, wept many, many, many tears. And I was a little bit disappointed in Ant-Man, I have to admit. It was a little bit boilerplate. It was a little bit typical. I took my wife to go see it because she's like, I don't like superhero movies. I don't like comic book movies, but I like looking at Paul Rudd. And I will look at Paul Rudd for an hour and 40 minutes. And I felt like Ant-Man and the Wasp was what I wanted Ant-Man to be. It was funny. It was goofy. It had a real sense of pop, a sense of humor. There were Morrissey jokes in it. It allowed Paul Rudd to be Paul Rudd. He wept reading my hated enemy John Green's book, The Fault in Our Stars. So yeah, I was very, very, very pleasantly surprised by Ant-Man and the Wasp. But even though it didn't set the world on fire, I thought it was a very, very overachieving superhero movie that I thought was a goddamn delight. All right, so number four, this is probably a little bit more predictable there, The Incredibles 2. Which I think counts, even though it was an animated motion picture.
Yeah, they're superheroes.
Yeah, the same kind of thing, where there's such expectations, particularly when you got a sequel to a movie that meant so much to people. It was about 12, 13 years after it came out. And again, it's kind of that Brad Bird genius of being able to combine this massive, massive story, you know, this epic, incredibly cinematic epic with these very grounded emotions and with these characters that are very, very, very deep, even though they're cartoons. I thought the bad guys in this one was really haunting. And yeah, Incredibles 2 and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, they were both about 2 hours long, which is very long for a motion picture movie, and particularly long when you consider that the Mask of the Phantasm only lasted 76 minutes and accomplishes so many things. But I felt like they both really deserved to be 2 hours long. And then finally, and you are not going to agree with me on this, Clint, I would imagine Deadpool 2, sort of like Ant-Man and the Wasp. This is what I wanted the first Deadpool to be. I'm like, well, this is nowhere near as in my face and outrageous and extreme. And I felt like with the second one, they kind of stopped trying so goddamn hard and allowed themselves to be emotional and to be funny and actually live in this world instead of constantly, you know, giving themselves the business and kind of living inside and outside of this universe at the same time. Felt like they stopped trying so goddamn hard with number two, which I really, really appreciated. What about you, Mr. Worthington?
Yeah, my number five is, I put Ant-Man and the Wasp on my list. I enjoyed the fact that the MCU is big enough that it can sort of branch out and, like, have all these different subgenres dominating it. And it feels like Ant-Man, especially with this film, firmly secures itself as, like, the sitcom wing of the MCU, where you can just kind of relax and have a really fun time. But number four, I think, is the real surprise, because it's the one that you guys haven't seen yet. It's one we haven't discussed, and that is Aquaman. I got the chance to see that early, or as I'm calling it and desperately hoping it becomes viral, Wet Thor.
I heard that movie was all wet.
It is. It's quite moist. Where, like, at the end, Jason Momoa is just fighting Patrick Wilson while dressed like a giant corn cob. It's pretty great. Yeah, like, I mean, it's funny that we have you on, Dan, because we talked about Flash Gordon last time, and there's a real Flash Gordon vibe to the ridiculous glam dumbness of Aquaman. Like, it feels like James Wan is leaning hard into the camp factor of Aquaman that I think it really makes that kind of vibe work. I think if you're the kind of person who defends things like John Carter and Jupiter Ascending and Tron Legacy and stuff, I think you're going to find a lot to like in Aquaman. And they find great uses for Jason Momoa's particular set of skills, which are just like being really dumb and muscly and charming.
Does he use the phrase, my man?
Unfortunately, he does not, but he does take
that's his catchphrase!
But he does take selfies with a biker gang that we think is going to try to beat him up at first. It's pretty great. He's just this wonderful, he has this lunkhead charm about it. I got to review it over at COS, and half of my review is just a rundown of all the goofy shit that happens in Aquaman. Like, an octopus plays the drums underwater.
But does it play him well?
Yes. Amber Heard's character wears this like jellyfish dress that like where the dress part is like tentacles, like glowy tentacles. It says something about a film when Willem Dafoe is the most grounded, normal character in it. And he plays an undersea like armsman who is a mentor to Aquaman.
Is it as horny as Flash Gordon?
It's pretty horny. There are many scenes in which Jason Momoa is soaked and shirtless. So that's pretty great. I didn't know I needed scenes where, like, an underwater meeting takes place between Patrick Wilson and Dolph Lundgren, who plays a major character in this movie with a big red beard.
That makes me very, very happy that Dolph Lundgren, A, is being employed in the non-direct-to-video world, and B, because he's fucking perfect. Is he Aquaman's dad?
No, he's not Aquadad, but he is like this general that is being roped into, because that's another thing. This movie's the exact kind of convoluted mess I'm all for, where you have to try to keep track of like seven different undersea kingdoms that they're trying to unite to wage war on the surface world. And it's a wild, wild ride. Julie Andrews voices a creature in it. I won't say what, but it's just amazing. I never thought in my life, in 2018, I would see a movie where there's a scene between Jason Momoa and Julie Andrews, but here we are.
Did Julie Andrews do motion capture for it as well?
Yes, I'm sure. I don't think they had footage of it, but go back and watch the mocap footage of Benedict Cumberbatch playing Smaug in the Hobbit movies, and it's very similar to that. Imagine Julie Andrews doing that instead, and it's pretty much the same thing. But it's just such a dumb little movie. It's huge and long and overstuffed and all over the place, but it's campy in the exact same way that I really, really like. But yeah, God, what else? My number three is Incredibles 2. I agree with you. I think it's a really solid superhero movie. I know people who like were like, oh, it's not as good as the first, but like, just imagine getting to see Brad Bird's incredible command of visuals and visual storytelling back for the first time since, like, I mean, I guess Tomorrowland, but no one watched that. But bringing that aesthetic back to animation, which is great. It's just a wonderful little story. I really liked that. My number two is Black Panther for all the reasons you said, and number one is Spider-Verse for all the reasons we all just said. So yeah, Dan, what's your list?
It's very similar to you guys' lists. So this is a very unsurprising list all around, I guess.
Yeah.
Although I will say that I'm being forced to rank these things. There are a couple of them that could easily switch places. I would put at number five Ant-Man and the Wasp. I thought it was a lot of fun. There are things that bothered me about it. Like, it's weird. It is really weird to nitpick an Ant-Man and the Wasp movie.
Yeah.
But for instance, the fact that Paul Rudd is able to go out and gallivant about and do all the stuff that he does, and the FBI doesn't actually think to check his home during any of it, beggars belief a little bit.
Well, I love
as well.
I said I love the fact that they made an action movie about somebody who's on house arrest the entire time.
Yeah.
That itself seemed like just a pretty magnificent cosmic joke. And he was obviously managed to find a way around it. But yeah, I love the idea that it's a dude who's ostensibly just in his house for like a month.
Yeah.
That's the essence of this, you know, $100 million comic book movie.
I also, this is a really like nerdy, nitpicky thing to say, but there's a scene at the end where where Michael Douglas puts down a house near the ocean and he embiggens it using his embiggening ray.
Yeah.
And Michelle Pfeiffer is standing next to him, his wife. And I wanted her to turn to Michael Douglas and be like, "That's great, honey, but is the plumbing hooked up to anything?"
It's just a septic like, tank. Yeah.
You can't just move around houses like that. There's such a thing as a foundation that you need to put down first.
Yeah, I feel like there's like some zoning issues there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just wait till the paperwork happens, yeah.
All my nerd objections aside, it was a very fun movie. Let's see, where would I go next? Probably Infinity War, which hasn't shown up yet on the list, but...
It's number six for me.
I really enjoyed it. I think that... It's a fucking insane undertaking.
Yeah.
And they do it with as much nimbleness and grace as I feel like I could have expected out of a movie that is like, let's just throw every superhero into a blender together and see what happens.
Yeah, it is kind of a miracle that it holds up as well as it does.
Yeah. And for... a movie where you're sure that the ending will be undone by the next movie. For that being true, it has a solemnness and a grim quality to the end of the film. Like the movie holds much more emotional weight than you would think it would, considering that none of us believe that those people are dead.
Yeah. Half of those people have sequels coming up. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was blown away that they're already trying to advertise the next Spider-Man movie. And I'm like, the Spider-Man's not alive again yet. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Anyway.
So that's my number four. It's very close to my number three, which is also Incredibles 2. I feel like this movie suffers a little bit from not having the clarity of purpose of the first Incredibles. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't feel like it needs to exist, kind of, but that doesn't matter because I agree with what you said about just the miracle of having Brad Bird's spatial like acuity, the way he can just put together a action sequence.
Yeah, that like train chase alone is worth the price of admission.
Exactly. I really love the Mission Impossible series and Fallout, the most recent one, is a terrific, terrific movie. I still feel like I love Ghost Protocol the most, Brad Bird's one. It's just got so much fun in the action sequences and creativity, and Incredibles 2 has that just in animation. And then, honestly, like my top two could flip. So I'm not really sure where to put them. One of them is Into the Spider-Verse, which we've already talked about, so I don't need to say anything about it. And the other one, of course, is Black Panther, which,
yeah,
you know, everyone talks about why it's great. I mean, it's been rehashed already. One of the things is it has a villain that is as sympathetic as the hero and adds a sort of a depth and complexity to the movie that you would not expect out of your average superhero film, and it's got such a great supporting cast. Each one of them could support their own movie. You would want to see them in their own movie. Mm-hmm. The Black Panther himself kind of suffers for that because everyone is so colorful around him, but
yeah.
He should not be underrated as like just a solid center to everything that's going on around him.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of need that straightforward center. And if anything, like, he's novel for being a Marvel superhero that doesn't quip. you know, that he's straightforward. He's the boring guy. Like, and that's part of his, like, that's part of his personality.
Yeah. Well, there's a dignity to him, a substance. And again, that Michael B. Jordan, I think, is one of the best performances in any comic book movie ever. There's a real Shakespearean depth and complexity to him. I fucking loved that performance. You know, Heath Ledger won an Academy Award. I think Michael B. Jordan at least deserves to be nominated for, giving one of the definitive superhero bad guy performances.
Well, it's got to be this or Creed 2. You got to make up your mind. Why not both?
Speaking of Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, very true. The only thing I can think to say from here is if we were to stretch the definition of a superhero movie, I really wish I'd found time for Upgrade in there, because I feel like there's an argument to be made that Upgrade's a superhero movie.
Upgrade would definitely make my top five if it was a superhero film.
Yeah, totally.
That motion picture is fantastic as well.
If only despite Venom.
There's even an element of superheroes to Mandy. In part because it has some like genuine fucking monsters in it. You know, you got people with having fights with chainsaws. I mean, even like Fallout to me in a little bit kind of felt like a superhero movie, with Tom Cruise being a real life superhero and also a real life supervillain. So he's got that complexity and the contradictions going within him.
And he fights Superman, so you know.
That's true, for sure. And Superman is way fucking better in that than he ever was in any of those damn Superman movies.
Very, very true. All right, let's move on. And now it's time for podcast recommendations. Nathan, what are you recommending this week?
I'm going to be very lazy and recommend The Flophouse, which continues to be I've recommended it before, but it's just a goddamn delight. And every episode, I adore it. You know, I can listen to it over and over and over again. And I have this nice experience where, you know, I'll go and watch a movie later, and then I will go back and listen to the Flophouse episode on it. And I get so much more out of it. You know, I mean, I could literally listen to you guys talk about anything. But is that Kenneth Anger movie that's just a blue screen?
Well, we usually do. we usually do talk about anything. It's rare that we talk about the movie.
But it was interesting that, like, I thought the Interview with the Vampire episode was particularly interesting, because I felt like that was a different kind of movie, where obviously there are cheesy elements of it, there are dated elements of it, there are bad elements of it, but I feel like that's not necessarily a bad movie in the same way that things you talk about are bad movies. And I thought, like, it'd be interesting if you, like, opened a window there to different kinds of movies that are flawed without necessarily being Death Wish.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan, what's your pick?
There's a show that I've been enjoying very much. It just ended its second season. It's called Heavyweight. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Goldstein hosts it. He was on This American Life long ago. And so it's a little bit in that vein, although maybe not as twee as that sometimes gets.
He also
gets.
Did Wiretap.
He did Wiretap, which I've heard good things about, but I've never listened
to. It's good. It's weird. It's very interesting. And very written podcasts are a whole different beast, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, so Heavyweight, the ostensible idea behind it is that everyone has kind of a day maybe in their life where they did something went wrong. You know, there's a regret in your life that Jonathan Goldstein is going to help you kind of go back and work through or figure out, or in maybe even in rare cases, redo somehow. And so there's this kind of wistfulness to it and heartfelt quality. But also Jonathan Goldstein himself as a character is very wry and funny. And each episode starts out with something that has nothing to do with the premise at all. Not thematically, not plot-wise, which is just Jonathan calls his friend Jackie at the start of every show and basically irritates her until she hangs up the phone. And it never fails to amuse me. And like I said, it has nothing to do with the rest of the podcast. I have no idea why it's there, except for that it's delightful. And yet somehow it's the perfect scene setting for the rest of the show. But it's, I love it.
Nice. Excellent. My recommendation is a podcast that I was going to recommend last time, but I chickened out because I wanted to listen to a little bit more of it. And this is Bill Corbett's Funhouse. Bill Corbett, who you might know from voicing Crow in the later seasons of the original run of Mystery Science Theater, and now is part of like the Riff Trax team. He was always my favorite. He has this wonderful voice, this mellifluous presence, and he's also a great, great Twitter presence if you're not following him. He has this podcast where he brings on some friends of his, and they just kind of talk about general topics. Like, I think his most recent episode, he chatted with this veteran science writer about the complexities of invasive species and things about climate change and all that stuff. And it's all done with this very effervescent kind of attitude. It's a real easy listen. And so I recommend Bill Corbett's Funhouse.
And it's actually, did you guys see that, Riff Trax will next be covering a motion picture entitled Santa's Summer Holiday?
Summer House.
Oh, that's true. It'd make more sense. Yes. It was a summer holiday.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Summer House. I was pretty fucking excited to see that.
Summer Holiday? What is this, the war on Christmas?
I know. That's crazy.
Yes, we will be sending our cease and desist letter shortly to them for cribbing our idea. But anyway, yeah, no, I did see that. I'm very excited about that. All right, let's move on. All right, now it is time for the mailbag. Now, we tried to figure out what we wanted to do for this mailbag. Now, we wanted to answer this question from Jeremy Moran, who says, "Greetings, friends. When we are children, there's a tendency to see the actors in movies as their characters and their characters alone. We think swashbuckling heroes are swashbucklingly daring when the camera isn't rolling, and we think the villains remain evil in private. So my question to you is this. Do you recall an age where you became aware that the people you were watching on screen were actors and that characters were their creations? Thanks, Jeremy. Nathan, what do you think?"
That is a very good question, and I'm not sure necessarily that I do remember that kind of a divide there. But I think at a certain point I realized, like, oh, they don't make all of this up. I think that's maybe – I didn't necessarily think that I was watching a documentary or that I was seeing real life, but I thought that people just kind of made these things. I thought the magic just kind of happened. And I think when I discovered that it was written, I think that's kind of when – my goal. I had a lot of fun. I was like every child, where I wanted to be a little bit of everything. I wanted to be president of the United States. I wanted to be a police officer. And then once I realized, like, oh, these movies are written by people and they make up these stories, I'm like, well, I want to do that. I want to be one of these people. And I remember writing writing like a 14-page screenplay, ironic quotation marks, and it was about a man who lives next door to a vampire. It was very derivative of the movie Fright Night, but it was all called Bucket of Blood. So yeah, I think that kind of being cognizant that movies were written by some weird person who made up crazy ideas, and wanting to be that person who made up the crazy ideas. I think those kind of happened simultaneously. Like, these writers who make up these movies, they must be the most amazing human beings in the whole world. They must have so much job security.
We are. We are the most amazing human beings in the world.
We're pretty great. We should be paid a hero's wage.
With no undue modesty. Right, right. But yeah, so I think that's what it was. How about you, Clint?
I don't know if there was a specific moment more than just like a series of little moments, but I'm willing to bet that one major factor was, I think, like when I was really, really young and realized and seeing for the first time, I don't know which one I saw first, whether it was Star Wars or Indiana Jones, but it was maybe it was like watching my first Indiana Jones movie and seeing Han Solo there playing a different character. And I think there was something in my cognition that put the pieces together that this is a guy playing Han Solo and Indiana Jones as different people, but he's the same person. And I think maybe I'm willing to bet that that was like a major indicator to me as to like the puppet strings of filmmaking and cinema and storytelling, to see like, oh, these are a series of people who make these stories. Sometimes the same people do different things. But I'm also willing to bet that there's also like a number of different factors that just made me realize that like there wasn't like a switch that went off. You just sort of one day thought of movies or TV shows or something in that framework through the lens of like production and knowing it's a story and that kind of thing.
Something gets made as opposed to something that just kind of happens or exists.
Exactly. It doesn't just materialize out of the ether. Like, Dan, do you want to weigh in on this one?
In my memory, like, I have this very flattering memory where I'm just like, I was never that dumb. Like, like I always
I never
knew.
Thought Santa was real.
Yeah. The one thing that I remember kind of along these lines, speaking of riff tracks, was the point at which I realized that the Mystery Science Theater guys weren't just making it up as they went along when they riffed.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
That was the revelation for me, which is funny because years later, the Flophouse has done a bunch of riffing shows. We don't do it so much anymore, but we did just improvise our way through those shows. And I can tell you, we were much less funny having not written out. If we didn't have indulgent fans who are happy to listen to whatever nonsense we come up with, it would have been a disaster. But that's the similar thing that, I don't know, occurs to me.
All right, well, Jeremy, thanks so much for your question. If you want to be a cool kid like Jeremy, you should ask us questions by emailing us at asknathanrabinshappycast@gmail.com. All right, moving on. Now let's close out with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place this week?
Well, this is one that happened yesterday. I went with my my Jewish son, Declan Haven, who is absolutely obsessed with Christmas. We went to the Christmas festival at Stone Ridge Mountain, which is kind of a fascinating place. I don't know how much y'all know about it. It's actually the neighborhood that Donald Glover comes from, and they have this giant sort of hill, kind of like a Mount Rushmore type thing, except you have all of these Confederate generals up there. I'm being a bit of a northerner still myself. I'm like, that's, and it's also, they play, it's almost impressive. They seek out the worst music in the world, the most hillbilly-ish music, the most redneck music in the world. And it's amazing. There's a part where there's artificial snow. And this will seem very bizarre to the both of you, but people are so excited to see snow that they pay money to experience it. It's this complete, you know, antithesis of how it is in Chicago. And my son was just so goddamn happy. He was very much in his element. So my happy place was being with my son and indulging his Christmas fixation, even though, you know, he's Jewish and he knows that we don't celebrate Christmas. We just look up and envy the goys who do.
Indeed. Dan, what about you?
I don't know. I've been through some heartbreak and turmoil lately. The less said about it, the better, particularly on a public podcast. But I have been fortunate enough to have a few very supportive and indulgent friends who I've been able to speak with. And it seems very trite to recommend or endorse the idea of having friends. But I think that's where my brain is going right now in terms of a happy place.
No, of course.
I think there are some Randy Newman songs that he wrote for Pixar. Which I'm strongly in favor of having friends. You're my friend, friends to the end.
I think I'm more of a fan of the Randy Newman songs where he talks about how short people don't got no reason to live. It's a dark side to the normally sunny singer-songwriter. As per usual, I get a little greedy with mine, so I've probably got a little like three or four small ones. One is I just got new furniture, got a new like couch, which is a weird thing to be like super happy about, but considering that we've had the same couch for like 6 or 7 years and it was literally on its last legs, and for some reason it feels very adult to go into a furniture store and be like, I want this couch, you're going to deliver it to me, I'm going to tip the moving guy for bringing it in, and suddenly we sit down and it's like we're in a Better Homes and Gardens issue So there's something like weirdly adult and comforting about that. And it's a very comfy couch, which is very nice since I work from home and I'm a freelancer and I want somewhere to sit with my cat on my lap. And also we had a really big holiday party. We sort of had a post-Hanukkah party where like we had a surprisingly big turnout and we had a lot of fun, had a lot of our close friends over and we all had a good time. They all fell in love with my cat, which is great. Yeah. And in addition to that, you know, like I said before, I'm sort of reaching the end of an era with my site, Alcohollywood, which will still be going, but we're doing a bit of a rebranding as like I get older and B, I realize that this podcast I've been doing for 7 years, like we're sort of reaching the end of our entropy a little bit and we want to like sort of revitalize it. So we've been starting to make strides towards that and it feels very exciting. It's the end of an era, but it feels like the beginning of a new one. And that is making me particularly happy. Which is nice. All right, that wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Raymond's Happy Cast, I believe. Dan, thank you so, so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure. Literally anytime you want to come on the show, you're more than welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you guys so much. This went super, super well. Thank you so much for staying up. It was very much worth it.
Yes, absolutely. Now we'll all flip away to our various respective universes. So thwip, 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 thwip. That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's HappyCast. You can find me on Twitter at Alcohollywood and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/NathanRabinsHappyCast. Our theme song is by John Beacon. Check out his stuff at johnbeacon.com. Until next time, I bid you a hearty whoop whoop.